And we're having a work session on House Bill 5030, the Department of Human Services, seniors and people with disabilities, and just a couple of housekeeping items. If there's anyone in the audience who has a cell phone, please turn it off so that it doesn't disrupt the proceedings. And we also have with us today Rosie and Rosette, who are here to remind us that when you use alphabets or acronyms, that they would like for you to contribute so that the – and if Senator Carter was here, she'd say they like green, not the coins. And the funds at the end of session will go to the Oregon Food Bank. So with that, Mr. Britton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, today we'll be doing a preliminary work session on House Bill 5030, the Department of Human Services, Seniors and People with Disabilities cluster. Sheila Baker went over three other clusters with you in a preliminary manner, and that's what we'll be doing with this budget cluster today. I'll hand out another copy of my memo and the spreadsheet in a second, but what we are hoping to accomplish this afternoon is to approve the adjustments on that spreadsheet, to approve a special purpose appropriation to the emergency fund related to the Staley resettlement agreement, and to approve the performance measurements related to this particular budget cluster. So with that, I will pass these out to you.
I'm going to get them straight up anyway. Went out yesterday.
Didn't get it.
I didn't either. My staff might have got it, but I didn't.
Have you changed? Did you change this?
Did you get this?
No. Is this different from what I had?
I don't know. I have not seen it until today.
No, I'm either.
Are you move this? Are you planning moving this budget today?
We're moving the preliminary today.
Okay.
It's similar to what we have done with all the budgets,
and, they're gonna hold them
and then they hold them over, and then we bring everything back.
Co-chairs are okay.
I don't get it until they, yes.
Is this what you have said?
I might want to explain to both the audience as well as members. Today's work session follows the same kind of work session that we've done with the other budgets, where we are approving these as preliminary budgets, which will come back to be incorporated into the overall 5030, so there's some of the items in here that will subject, for example, I know that there's probably some concerned about survival levels. You know, there's still discussion going on about those levels, but this takes us to a place to where we can get some of the initial work out of the way, so that when it's time for us to present the overall budget, we will have most of the detailed work done. This is not a public hearing, because we've had public hearing on this particular budget some time ago. We are now at the place where we are in work session, and because the human services budget is so complex, there are several pieces to it, and Mr. Britton will walk us through this, because we're dealing not only with the 0305, but we're dealing with the reshoot numbers, and I want you to keep that in context as we walk through it. because often there is a misunderstanding when we say reshoot, and some people think, well, oh, my gosh, I got we had done a rebalance. Well, we moved from rebalance to reshoot, and then we'll get into 0305. Do you have a question?
No, just a comment, Madam Chair. Representative Scott informed me that if we need him,
right,
you know where to get him.
I met him in the hallway.
Okay,
so
you did meet him. Okay,
I did meet him. So, Mr. Britton.
Madam Chair and members, I'd like to start with the spreadsheet and again underscore what Chair Winters just said, and that is that this is not the final budget for the seniors and people with disabilities cluster. I fully expect there to be further adjustments made to this budget. But what we are trying to do here is to take care of things related to the co-chair's budget and also the reshoot of the governor's budget. Now, as Chair Winters said, we did a rebalance earlier in the session, which took care of the 2001-03 budget. But as far as the reshoot is concerned, we then take those new caseloads that were done for the rebalance, and we adjust the governor's budget for those changes.
Senator Marcet, I know she knew. Would you like to sit with us up here?
So let's start with the first page of the spreadsheet. The first page down through the adjustment of 15, and I'll walk you through these one by one, but the first 15 lines of the spreadsheet show what the agency submitted to us as far as the reshoot of the governor's budget was concerned. The first line, for example, is the reshoot of the developmentally disabled mandated caseload. So you can see that there is a slight increase in the caseload. In addition, the reduction of other funds is related to the phase out of a program that ended during the 2001-03 biennium that provided some other fund revenue to help some rehabilitation facilities with their workers' compensation costs. That was done through Senate Bill 288. That program was not phased out in the governor's printed budget, so it's being phased out here, and that's what accounts for the $4 million reduction in other funds. The second line is a reshoot of the seniors' mandated caseload. Again, caseloads generally, since the governor's printed budget was constructed, have gone up. But in addition, there were some other adjustments made to that overall caseload and the numbers for the long-term care caseload for seniors related to MUPL adjustments. In other words, there was the stripping out of some other funds, reduction in federal funds related to the MUPL mechanism that we use. Line 3 is simply a reduction in the forecast for estate recoveries. We heard some of that, I believe, during a public hearing. We talked a little bit about why that was so. Here in the reforecast of estate recoveries, we're saying that those recoveries will be $5.3 million less than what was included in the governor's printed budget, hence the need for a backfill of general fund of the same amount. The biggest adjustment here is on line 4, and I've labeled it the restatement of the governor's budget reductions. And what that means is that when the governor's printed budget was being constructed, there were a number of House Bill 5100 reductions that were included or assumed in that budget. Primarily, the largest one of those was a reduction of survival priority levels all the way down from 17 down to level 6. Now, in reality, that's not what happened, and CMS informed the department after the governor's printed budget was being built that that was not going to be able to happen. They would not allow that. So the survival priority levels were reduced down through level 10, and to compensate for the loss of the cut or the reduction, because the additional levels hadn't been cut, there was a reduction in provider rates. Providers of adult foster care, assisted living facilities, residential care facilities, nursing facilities, all those provider rates were cut in lieu of survival priority level reductions. When
Senator Carter.
John, so all the general fund is taken out, just the other funds are maintaining themselves to pay for that? Is that, am I on the wrong line?
I don't recall the other funds increase there. I'm not certain of that. I'd have to look back at the detail behind that. But what's happening here is, again, what I said, we're actually increasing caseload for those survival priority levels, but we're also decreasing provider rates fairly significantly. By 15% for adult foster homes, residential care facilities, by 30% for assisted living facilities. Now, you'll notice that there's an increase in positions, and while there is also a decrease in the overall budget there, the increase in positions is associated with the staffing because caseload goes up because you've added back survival priority levels. So the point is that this restatement is shows that with the governor's policy direction, finally, after the governor's budget had already been printed, there were greater reductions available for 0305 than had been anticipated in the original governor's printed budget by about $33 million general fund.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gordley.
Thank you. Mr. Britton, and then how are we to look at the federal funds? Is that a loss of federal funds, funds we're leaving on the table?
Madam Chair and Senator Gordley, absolutely. In this budget, especially in the seniors budget, but also in the DD, the developmentally disabled budget here, whenever you cut general fund, as a general rule, you're going to be cutting federal funds because this is in large part Medicaid matchable general fund in this budget. So the answer is yes.
Madam Chair.
Diminishing, if I may follow up.
Yes, follow up.
Well, the irony is that we have an increasing caseload, but we're losing federal dollars to service that caseload.
Madam Chair and Senator Gordley, you're correct. That's right. Now, you'll see after we're done here that we're going to be doing some add backs as well.
Let me step back a little bit. Page one is to give the overview, if you will, of what the reshoot looks like. What happened after the governor and it printed his budget, then we went to an operational phase, then we went into what's called the reshoot. If you will let John walk through this, you will see now where we are in preparation for the 0305 budget will then be to correct what has occurred on page one and how he went about that and what is proposed for 0305. So I think it'll become clear if we let John walk us through all of the elements, and then we can get to where the dollars are coming back into the budget.
You mean the federal dollars coming back into the budget, Madam Chair?
Madam Chair and Senator Gordley, both general fund and federal dollars.
It's
right.
Not.
Right.
This one is, I guess, the best way of explaining it is that, and I step back because I've always talked about how complex this particular agency's budget is. And one of the reasons for the complexity is that unlike other budgets where you have a line item and they come in at the end of the year and they either spend it or they didn't spend it, this agency's budget is driven by caseloads. And it could be a caseload in one part of the agency operation, also caseloads that occur in another part of the agency's operation. Because of that, the agency comes back to us a lot more frequently than other budgets because we allow them to make shifts, if you will, inside of their budget categories. We allow, if they're having a need someplace over here, if it's within federal guides, that we shift dollars here and vice versa. So that requires a lot more detailed accounting, if you will, and shifting. And it takes a little while, particularly this session. Normally, we will have already have done this at the first part of the year. But because we had the activity that went on in special session, we also had the issue of a governor newly coming into office, and that happens when you get that transition from a preceding governor to a new governor, so that governor can craft his or her budget. The numbers have changed since we first began the first of the year. So there's a lot that has gone on with this agency. So that's why we ended up with this reshoot, so that we can somehow come with numbers that more nearly reflect what has happened to clean up 01, 03. And then we will get from there to 03, 05. That makes sense to everybody.
It makes sense, Madam Chair. In the end, what I would like to have my arms around is what is the actual loss in overall in federal funds, meaning the opportunity to serve Oregonians who are most in need. What does that dollar figure look like? In the end.
Madam Chair and members, we'll get there.
Okay, thank you.
And actually, I'd like Madam Chair to take over. You're doing a great job.
You're excused, John.
Yeah, you don't need me. On line five is the elimination of the department-wide support services prorate mechanism. Sheila Baker has no doubt talked about this, particularly with respect to the department-wide support services. Each of the other clusters are probably giving up funds in this way, and you'll see those funds actually arriving in the department-wide support services cluster. Line six is the change in the Medicaid Title 19 match rate from 60.16% to 60.81%. And you can see in this budget it's worth about $9.1 million of the ability to backfill general fund with that higher federal match rate.
And I might explain that that rate is adjusted annually. It's federally adjusted annually, and it's based on relative income. And if you know that Oregon right now, we're not at a place to where we're talking about, you know, high incomes. And so that's the baseline in which the federal government uses in order to calculate that rate. So that's why you have that increase. We have that bump, if you will.
Line seven is to remove some empty other funds limitation from the Eastern Oregon Training Center budget of about $400,000. Line eight is to remove some Fairview services and supplies and personal services funding that was inadvertently left in the governor's printed budget. The state has sold the Fairview property and is in the process of being paid over time for that property. What I've labeled as on line nine as DD, developmentally disabled housing, is that these are carryover funds for in the other fund column, along with some general fund that goes through the treasury and is returned to this cluster as other funds. To do maintenance on state-owned properties that are used to care for people with developmental disabilities. So, in other words, we have some additional carryover to do maintenance on those properties, and it can be used to backfill some general fund in this budget. A couple of technical adjustments, lines 10 and 11 are transferring positions from the community human services budget to the seniors budget, and one from the seniors budget to the department-wide support services. Line 12 is the elimination of inflationary money that was again inadvertently left in special payments. That removes about $10.7 million of general fund. And finally, with respect to the reshoot, line 13 is to remove retired senior volunteer program general fund of about $275,000. This was a December allotment reduction, as I recall. And in the reshoot, The department is removing that money. You'll see that comes back in a moment, and I'll explain why. But on line 15 is the total reshoot request as far as reducing the overall budget and restating the governor's budget. At this point, we have then reduced the survival priority levels down to level 9, so 10 through 17 are eliminated. Provider rates have been reduced anywhere from 15% to 30% for assisted living facilities. And there is no inflation adjustment for rates in the 03-05 biennium. So this is a restatement, in other words, of the governor's policy and program choices on line 15. About $56.2 million less than what was in the governor's printed budget in the way of general fund. Now, let's continue. Line 16 is an attorney general rate reduction. You've seen these before on other budgets that we have done. This is the share that goes into the seniors' budget. Line 17 is a merit freeze adjustment of about $1.5 million general fund. You've seen these kinds of adjustments as well. Our vacancy position analysis and discussions with the department, we are recommending that you remove 42 positions, 39.33 FTE, $1.9 million of general fund. We provided this list to the agency, and they made several recommended adjustments to us, which we accepted. Again, the overall vacancy position savings about $1.9 million of general fund and associated matching federal funds. Line 19, we are recommending that you remove inflation adjustment for in-home providers. In a moment, I gather we'll have a discussion about the Home Care Commission that the governor is recommending. The $25 million cost of that program is now exclusive of this $4.2 million adjustment. In other words, if this had been left in, the cost would not be $25 million. It would be $20.8 or so. Line 20 begins a list of co-chair reductions that were in the co-chair's budget. This is to remove funding from the Oregon Project Independence to reach a maintenance of effort, or really a match level, of $3.3 million, which is used to match Older Americans Act funds. The co-chairs had originally wanted to remove $5 million, but they are cognizant of the $3.3 million matching issue. So this reduction takes away $3.7 million, leaves $3.3 million for matching on Older Americans Act funds. $500,000 to eliminate general fund funding for the employment initiative. This is a relatively small program within the seniors' budget. However, it provides general funds for employment activities targeted at persons who are on Medicaid who are otherwise not eligible for vocational rehabilitation services. So these funds are used to buy things that if a person were eligible for voc rehab services, the general fund and match associated with that program would buy it, but these people are apparently not eligible for those services. So this would reduce the number of placements into work. Line 22, central admin vacant positions. This was a December of 02 allotment plan reduction rolled up for 03-05, two positions, two FTE. Then on line 23, we see the add back for the Staley resettlement agreement. You may recall that in the governor's printed budget, there was a reduction of about $85 million general fund and associated federal match associated with the Staley settlement agreement. This is an add back of $55 million because the plaintiffs came back to the table with the state of Oregon to reach a compromise agreement. So the add back is $55 million. However, it also turned out that there was $14.4 million of general fund that had been built into the governor's printed budget to accommodate increased caseload if Staley were not added back. So we can net those two numbers. The overall add back is about $40.7 million. The co-chairs, by the way, had about $56.2 million because at the time we were working on the co-chairs budget, that was the best information we had. So the co-chairs set aside $56.2 million. In reality, the cost is about $40.7 million. Line 24 is the restoration of survival priority levels 10 and 11. Cost of about $19 million general fund, and again, associated federal match. The co-chairs had added originally line survival priority level 10 and had budgeted $12 million for level 10 only, but because of the savings associated with Staley, they felt it important to go ahead and add back both levels 10 and 11. And as an aside, Staley and the survival priority levels 10 and 11 and the next one, the restoration of provider rates, were all in Senate Bill 5548, which was passed during the sixth special session earlier in our regular session. Line 25 is the restoration of long-term care provider rates to their 2001-03 final levels for nursing, assisted living, adult foster home, and residential care facilities. So those rate reductions I mentioned a moment ago of 15% and 30% are removed in this particular add-back. The co-chairs in their budget had set aside about $40 million for that add-back. Finally, a few other LFO recommendations. House Bill 2156, which passed through the subcommittee, I believe, last week or the week before, would add about $233,000 incrementally of estate collections that can offset a similar amount of general fund. You see on line 27 the enhanced federal Medicaid match rate savings of about $32 million general fund. This was
Senator Cardin.
John, help my brain, enhanced federal Medicaid match.
Senator Carter, this was the congressional action that took place, I believe, back in June, which helped states on a temporary basis by improving their federal Medicaid match rate by about 2.95%. And this is the piece within this budget that frees up about, as I said, $32.1 million general fund. Then finally, line 28 is the removal of the double cut. It turned out that the RSVP program had been cut in the governor's printed budget. The reshoot cut it again, so this is simply adding it back. It remains cut, so if you wanted to add back that program, this is an additional $275,000 on top of this, but this at least removes the double cut. We can't cut things more than once. So line 29 shows the subtotal of these other recommended adjustments of about $57 million general fund net. Total preliminary budget is on line 30, about $735.3 million general fund, total funds of about $2.2 billion. 1,598 positions, 1,560.88 FTE.
I was trying to see what was different than what we went over yesterday, and it's the enhancement dollars of 32.75.
That's right.
Questions?
Madam Chair.
I'll get Senator Carter and then Senator Morris.
John, maybe I wasn't listening. John did define the difference between special purpose and E-fund.
Yes, Madam Chair and Senator Carter, I'll talk about. Do you want me to talk about that
now?
Yes,
you might as well.
Okay.
I understand, but I'm not so sure.
Okay, be happy to. On line 31, we are recommending that the Assembly establish a special purpose emergency fund appropriation for Staley, which is a piece of the $735.3 million. It's not in addition to that number. And what is going on there is that the budgeted amount, and indeed the amount that is in the Staley agreement, is about a monthly cost for adult support services of about $800 a month. We've seen those costs over 2001-03 to be about on the order of $500 to $550 a month. So what we're saying here is we're okay with the budgeted cost of about $800, and the agency has said that they expect those costs to increase because there's some more costly people being phased in during the 03-05 budget period. But what we're recommending is that we set aside that difference between an $800 cost and a $500 cost in the emergency fund as a special purpose appropriation. Thereby, if the agency needs the money, if costs are coming in at $800 or $700 a month, they can come in, request the money from the emergency board, and it can be allocated if that's the emergency board's wish. I want to make a distinction between a special purpose appropriation and a reservation. They are two different things. A reservation can be removed by the emergency fund at any time. This cannot. This is a special purpose appropriation to the emergency fund.
And this is very important, because one of the things that we did not want to happen was that if their costs went up, that we did not want them to be in a position where they could not access those dollars. And so by making it a special purpose, this body can't have free rein to go after those funds. It is specified for them. The co-chairs and no one else can go dip in to those dollars. And so I need to put that on record so everybody understands the distinction between if it was just dollars in the E-fund versus where you have dollars that are set aside specifically that are what they call special purpose. And that's what this is about, so that we're assuring that that they have access should their needs go up. Should they find that the cost is greater than the $550 what they're currently experiencing, that they have the ability and have the dollars to do the job that they say that they need to do. And so that I wanted to make sure that everyone understood that we're not taking the dollars away from them. We're keeping access for them. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. John, what would make these costs go up from $500 to $800?
Madam Chair and Representative Smith, as I understand it, and the department can speak more directly to your question, they are phasing in a number of people who have been doing vocational work, and I'm looking for some head nods, that are more costly than the people that they have been serving to date with respect to adult support services.
Why?
Margie, you want to come up and, or James, Mr. Tathan, and explain it.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, to go back, when we negotiated the Staley agreement originally, what the plaintiffs wanted was full access to 24-hour care. included in the package. And as part of some long and rather painful negotiations, we ended up with an entitlement not to 24-hour services, but to non-24-hour services, which could be a combination of employment, in-home support to families, in-home equipment, respite care to families. And this, in most cases, are families that maintain a son or daughter with very severe disabilities at home, who are adults who otherwise would have to leave the home. In picking the original $800 amount, we took that as the average in-home cost in the long-standing senior and physical disability in-home program and simply used crosswalk that and said, well, we have an existing standard there for average in-home cost for people with severe disabilities or complex needs living in their own home. When we started this program and started phasing it in, we took many individuals and families that had only gotten little bits of family support or nothing at all historically. And so initially a lot of these families have not requested that much. They have not demanded the full amount that they would have been entitled to even under the agreement. But we think as these plans, and initially a lot of the original plans were from a prior program called Family Support, which again was just little tidbits of respite care and other small services. In many cases, as they were enrolled in Staley, their old plans just got rolled over as we enrolled people. And we believe as those plans are now renewed and they have access to the fuller package of services that they're entitled to, that that's in fact what they will request. The second question Mr. Britton was bringing up is included in the enrollment schedule for Staley are bringing everybody who historically received employment services in the developmental disability system but were not in 24-hour care, and they all became part of the non-24-hour Staley package. And in many cases, those are people with very severe disabilities whose current monthly costs are $900, $1,000, $1,200 a month. So they will all come in now into the blended average. And so we expect over time that we will clearly get to the $800 amount. It's simply a question of when. The only other thing I would add is in the settlement agreement itself, there is a $20,000 cap. No person entitled to the Staley side of the agreement is entitled to more than $20,000. And yet, obviously, you can't have an average of near that cap, or the costs would be much, much higher than they are now. And so, in fact, we've had to hold the average much lower than that, with some very tight rules controlling how people get more than the average based on complexity of need, family situation, and things of that sort. I know it sounds all kind of complex, but we were enrolling different populations from previous programs. We were blending old money and new money and creating this whole new entitlement pool, and that's why you've had these fluctuations.
$20,000 per
individual per year.
Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm a little confused. We've used the term adult support and we used the term family support. Are they one and the same with respect to this special purpose fund? Or
now, Madam Chair, Senator Morris, the family support program historically supported families that had both children and adults with severe disabilities living at home. Much of that family support fund was created originally out of the savings when Fairview closed. After that family support program had been around for some years, the Staley Agreement came along and applied only to adults, not to children. So that portion of families with adult sons and daughters living at home, we migrated out of family support into the Staley Agreement. But we took a portion of what historically were those family support dollars and also moved it into it was the combination of old and new funding to create the entitlement pool under Staley. What was left then in family support were simply dollars for children living at home with their families, but it's not part of an entitlement program under Staley. So the current family support program is only for children. Historically, it was for children and adults.
And Jim, what is the status of the family support funding then?
Madam Chair and Senator Morse, I don't know the answer to that question.
Do you know, Jen?
Okay. Madam Chair, Senator Morris, the family support budget is it is part of the $55 million associated with Staley, and that's partly because when the settlement agreement was put into place, although the majority of that agreement was around an entitlement program to adults with developmental disabilities, there was also a caveat that we would not decrease a level of funding for family supports to children at that time. Although the Staley settlement would have, over time, increased that amount as part of the renegotiations, that budget returned to the $99.01 amount of dollars, which is about $4.2 million of general fund. So within that $55 million that has been identified under the Staley settlement support, $4.2 million of that is for children who are supported in the family support program.
Follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The 4.2, is that similar to, much less than, previously allocated and budgeted?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, the amount is less than last biennium's. Last biennium's amount of money started with 4.2 in as the allocation, and then the settlement agreement increased it almost by 50%. So last biennium's budget, and primarily the last year in the budget, was the time period where that increase occurred. Beginning in this last period, starting in February, we froze enrollments to family support programs, and as part of settlement, looked at the definitions of what was required, which was to not go below that 4.2. So there is indeed a reduction of almost 50% of family support services to children.
What problem does that create?
Madam Chair, I think the use of that program has really been instrumental in programs such as respite, et cetera, and it has it's been a valve release for families. And without that, the increase of families going into crisis and perhaps requesting services that are much more extensive is one of the outcomes that could occur. So certainly not having a reduction in that amount means that we might be dealing with families whose ability to maintain their whole family unit is stretched even farther, in either waiting for access to services that are a lot slower or not having access to services at all.
I want to just shift a little bit I noticed on the list that there was funds that one hadn't anticipated on Fairview. Mr. Tate, can you tell me what's the status? I know that we've sold the property. I know that they're paying for the property in installments. And has the trust account been set up for those dollars, and who's managing that trust account?
Madam Chair, you're correct. The Fairview property has been sold. We received the first installment in payments, I think, 2+ years ago. The second installment, I think, comes in at the end of August. I could check exactly the date, but it's coming up fairly shortly. It's after the second installment that we'll actually turn over the title to the property. The trust fund is set up, and the rules have been adopted, and the rules have been filed. I don't think they're permanently adopted yet. At this point in time, however, we have expended no funds out of that trust fund because we were waiting for that, for the corpus of the trust fund to actually start to develop, because we're prohibited by law from using anything but the interest. So we didn't want to chip away at just the first or second payment, but allow that to accrue over time.
Is the Treasurer's Office managing the funds? Who's managing the fund?
Madam Chair, it is a Treasury account specifically in statute for this program.
I guess I'm asking the questions because I want to make certain. We worked awfully hard. I see Catherine in the back, she and I and others, to make certain that these properties, when we pushed to get the sale done so that we could begin getting those monies into a trust account. And so I just want to make certain that we're getting our earnings and that we're doing all of our fiduciary responsibilities so that we can begin seeing these dollars grow. And that's the reason for my question and wanting to know the status and to assure that we are doing some good management of the dollars.
And Madam Chair, we'd be happy to provide more detail on how much is in the fund. And
I would like that. It's one that I've been very closely involved with, and I'm very interested to make certain that.
We will do that.
Thank you. You have a comment,
Madam Chair and members. I was going to just simply kind of summarize where we are with this preliminary budget, if you would want me to do that and respond to Senator Gordley.
Certainly.
At this point on line 30, we've added back levels 10 and 11. We have restored provider rates to their final 2001-03 levels. We have at least funded OPI at a maintenance of effort level at $3.3 million. We have taken care of the reshoot of the governor's budget. We have not added inflation for provider rates into the 0305 biennium.
Senator Morris.
Thank you. If I might go back to the Staley
okay. In
discussion about the family care and the services and adult support services. As I understand it, there's approximately a $300 delta that's going to be set aside in a special purpose fund that would be accessed as the need would increase for adult services.
Madam Chair and Senator Morris, the recommendation is exactly a $300 per month on the adult services portion of the Staley resettlement agreement would be in a special purpose appropriation to the emergency fund.
And how much was that, Madam Chair?
It's about 6.3. It's on the very bottom on line 31.
On the 31?
Well, I added. I didn't have that for you yesterday, so it is.
Okay.
It's on
the
See, the yesterday sheets weren't numbered, and today I think they are numbered.
And a couple minor charts.
Okay.
Thank you.
I have a question of Catherine. Could you come up, please?
I
just wanted to ask the question of the desires, and that's with respect to the special purpose issue and setting those monies aside, and whether you've had that discussion with the agency. And I know from my perspective and looking at it that we would want to protect the interest.
For the record, my name is Catherine White, and yes, I have talked both with Legislative Fiscal Office and with the Department about the intent to put that money aside and protect it, and we're okay with that.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Moore.
Madam Chair, and my question, if there are funds that are not accessed by the adult services, can they be utilized in the special purpose fund for family services?
Madam Chair and Senator Morris, that is up to the Assembly to define that special purpose appropriation. You could, for example, just leave it more open to say for Staley resettlement costs, leave it in a general kind of a term, or you could be more specific.
Madam Chair, to the extent that is possible, I would be interested in seeing something like that happen.
Catherine, would it be yours, and I would consult and yield to your wisdom whether you would like it left generally or specified.
Madam Chair,
we have the conversation later.
Yeah.
we'll have the conversation later. Okay?
Madam Chair, while Catherine White is there, I know that you have an issue related to criminal record checks, and the issue or concern is that they're taking a while to accomplish. While you're there, would you mind telling us what that issue is and why we need to be hearing about it now?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, the provider community, including those providers involved in Staley, have been running into some major implementation challenges, and that is the ability for the DHS to process the criminal record checks, which are required both by Oregon statute and Medicaid law in terms of having providers go through these criminal record checks. And they have been running into delays of 2 to 4 months in getting the record checks through. We've been hearing stories of ads put in newspapers where they've had 40 responses, and by the time they get the criminal record checks back 2 to 3 months later, there's nobody who's still interested in that position. We have families who lose a respite provider. They have the funding to pay for respite services, but they're not able to get a criminal record check through. It's been our experience that through the child care department and employment division, they're doing criminal record checks. We're getting responses back in 2 hours, 2 to 3 hours. And we raised it today because we felt it was it's a major implementation challenge for our system.
Senator Carter.
I just want to say to you, I've had 5 calls from my district on this. Some of the people who laid off in Multnomah County and does this kind of work for the county, but laid off in a 3-month period of time, and some of the homes wanted to employ them. And I've had 5 phone calls on this today.
Mr. Tay, can you come up a moment? Can I ask you a question? Is there a way that we can expedite the background checks?
Madam Chair, Jean Thorne, Director of the Department of Human Services. Between us, well, actually, this is part of Administrative Services. I do want to check out Catherine's comment about employment being able to process this within a couple of hours, because I know one of the we've had concerns raised about this, and there's kind of 2 levels of issues that have affected our ability to process these quickly. First of all, was just within our own agency, staff turnover, hiring freezes, et cetera. But the second issue has to do with if for a certain percentage, I'm not sure what that is, so I need to get back to you with more information, that we rely on the state police. If there's a certain, as I understand it, if there's any record that there has been either an arrest, that information then is required for the state police to go in and do some further checks, and I think also into the FBI. And because of the state police cutbacks that they've had over the last few months, that has slowed it down as well. So there's been 2 kind of our own internal, and we've been hiring more of the positions in there, and that piece has been speeding up. I can't tell you exactly what our processing there is. And then we have the second state police level of this. So I need to go back and get some more information and to see how if employment is able to turn around in 2 hours, what the difference is and whether it relates to any of the standards that we have to follow. But we'll get back to you with some more information about that.
While you're would you think about perhaps and see if it would be and talk to the employment and the child care division that maybe one solution is contracting with them if they're able to do a faster job? And I don't know how the state police figures in all this, but certainly 2 to 4 months is very, very problematic. And, you know, when we're in an environment now where we're trying to get people back to work and we're trying to get get people on jobs, and if we're taking that long to get people, you know, through our process, then I think we need to really, that should be one of our priorities, to make sure we're removing some of these roadblocks. And if you need some conversation with, let me know what's happening at the state police operation. But I would have a conversation with the employment division, and it could be, rather than dealing with the staff issue, you may be able to contract mm-hmm. with them and let them handle, if they're able to do it in a day or two, rather than to build staff for that purpose. Senator Gordon, and then.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to follow up and clarify, is it that the child care division has the two-hour turnaround and the employment division has the longer turnaround? Which is it?
Madam Chair, it's Senator Gordley. The child care division is a part of the employment division. And we run a child care program out of our office, and we're getting the turnarounds in about 2 hours.
I see. Through that particular office.
Yes.
Okay. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Winters. I know it's the middle of July, and we're all tired, but I think this is an issue that shouldn't be just brushed over. I'd be interested in knowing how many second-choice or third-choice employees we had to hire as a result of first-choice employees not being able to be hired in time as a result of these background checks taking so long.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair and Representative Smith, I'm not sure that we would be able to get at that information because we are doing the checks of the people who work for the nursing homes, for instance. And we have about 18,000 a month that we do, and so it would require us to contact all of the providers across our systems to find out. But I think we can't. This definitely is an issue that we're aware of. We've already taken some steps, but I think we need to look into it further and see what the differences are. I don't know if part of the difference might relate to different standards that are that because some different programs do have different standards of how far you need to check. And if you don't get some information right off.
Gene is also just to ask the follow-up question along. It could also be that with inside of various agencies, they do have the ability to access certain information easier than some other agencies do. And I know within Employment Division, they have access to probably some data that perhaps you do not.
Maybe.
And I think that needs to be clarified, whether that's a part of the easier access because of they're still operating under federal rather than state, and probably have some accesses that we don't. But I do think that if they're able to do it expeditiously, then certainly it's worth our exploring either maybe to just a contract with them to do it if they can do so, or to find out what it is that we're doing wrong. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Winters. I guess reiterating what you just stated, you know, a criminal background check when you purchase a handgun takes 10 minutes. And so I would hope that we could take the necessary steps to accomplish this. Because if the Sportsman's Warehouse can pull it off in 10 minutes, there's no reason why we shouldn't be able to do that.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I know one of the issues that we've been dealing with is as we centralized our criminal records checks, each program had some different databases and different requirements, and we are trying to standardize that as well so that we're not in a situation that with one provider we have certain things we have to check, and another provider type it's another set of things. So certainly, and we'll certainly take a look at what employment is doing to see what there is there that we can either learn from or to explore the possibility of subcontracting with them.
Gene, I would think that the background checks for child care should be similar in what you're wanting individuals or the standards that you would want them to have in dealing with our developmentally disabled population or anyone who is going in to take care of a person. Mm-hmm. I don't see how we would get into, you know, some dissimilarities when we're talking about criminal background checks. So I guess I would say that it's as quickly as you can mm-hmm. resolve this issue that as possible. I can't see where there would be that much divergence, if you will, between a person who is being checked out to take care of children. You know, and I know that we were very explicit in some of the laws that we passed with respect to the standards for child care, that how that would be any greatly different. In fact, I would think it would be more severe, if you ask me, than it would be on the other. So I, Senator Carter.
I know one of the people that called me, she's been cleared before, and nothing has changed, but this is just to go back through it again. And so I'm sure that's on the ground, and you probably don't know at the top, you know, how that's working. But it would appear to me if a person has been cleared once and there's no change in their status, why they have to wait for refills.
And I don't know. I'm sure Senator Carter will take a look at
Jean.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yeah.
All right, Mr. Britton.
Thank
you, Kathy.
Madam Chair and members, again, our recommendation to you for today is to approve the adjustments that I've just outlined. You may want to hold off on approving the special purpose appropriation until you have discussed that with the advocates. And finally,
we can go ahead because we're going to have to come back in anyway. So okay. We'll just do all of it with the understanding that we know that this is our preliminary, and so it is.
We'll define it later.
Madam Chair, I make recommendations that we put in.
Representative Bates.
Oh, sorry.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I just want to make sure my numbers were correct, and so I'm going to ask. A good LFO asked to compute these figures that I've got from a document you gave us back in April. It's got your name on it.
So, that's old stuff.
Oh, thanks.
But it gives me. But it gives me.
April.
I keep this stuff. Look at it. I'm a whack job, you know. Looking at this budget, I just want to point out that, and it's a difficult budget. All our budgets are going to be difficult, but. If the figures I have are correct, looking at sort of the forest and getting out of the trees here, we're looking at a budget that is about $250 million below what our last special session 5, for total funds for this group, if my figures are correct. We have not restored levels 12 of 17. Right. We've taken about $30 million out of Staley, and there's probably some other minor cuts that bring us up that figure. I just want to keep it in our minds as we go through these budgets. Well, even while these budgets have holes in them we have to fill, even at this level, we have taken cuts, and significant cuts, but done it, I think, in about the most judicious way we can. I think we'll probably hear more from advocates, their concerns, but this is not a budget that is rich. This is a budget that is less than after our special sessions. It's been done carefully by LFO staff and the chair, and I appreciate that. But let's not lose track of what we're doing here. We've had to cut budgets, and we still have holes to fill, even with budget cuts.
Yeah, and this budget, and you're correct, this budget does not complete the 12 through 17 issue that we're still discussing, nor does it include the inflation issues. And so there are still some issues pertaining to this particular budget. That's why, and I hope I prefaced it, that it is preliminary, that discussions are still in process. Senator Morse.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Before we vote, I'd like to come back and revisit OPI and at least share the discussions that I've had within my district. And the question was, at 3.3, is it still a viable program? And the response that I got back was, no, it is not, with respect to the level of overheads and essentially the caseload assigned to people, caseloads, that it, the recommendation was that if it wasn't increased in funding, maybe consideration should be to drop it. Now, that's not my recommendation. I want to share that concern within my district with respect to the funding level and the viability of the program, that it seriously calls it into doubt as to whether it should be continued.
There are two policy questions that are still outstanding with respect to that particular discussion, and that is, would you do Project Independence and not bring back 12 through 17? You know, we have enjoyed continual care. So those policy discussions are still taking place, and including the issue that you bring to the table, at what level us. Representative Smith has been working with the on the OPI issue. I've asked her to really work and flesh that particular issue out. But there is the bigger discussion. That there is the other discussion as we talk about linkage and program. And so that's why this is, I think I prefaced it. There's still some work left to be done with respect to this particular budget. And so that's why the recommendation that this is preliminary. It is not, and I'm going to repeat it, it is not the final product. Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And we had a reference to the Home Care Commission. I assume John was going to
if we if we get this one out, the Home Care will come up next.
Okay, thank you.
And Madam Chair and Senator Morris, the Home Care Commission $25 million would be in this budget, but it has not been added back or agreed to by the overall assembly at this point.
So that's why it's not here. But I did ask for Mr. Weeks to come and to bring us up to date on the home care piece. So that's in addition to this. Ready? In addition to questions, Senator Carter is ready. All right, Senator Carter.
Madam Chair, I move that the senior... I move that we accept the recommendation of LFO regarding the seniors and people with disabilities budget on a preliminary basis.
Senator Carter moves that we accept the recommendations as outlined by Legislative Fiscal Office with the understanding that they are preliminary, that this is preliminary in nature. Are there any objections to accepting the recommendations?
Madam Chair.
Senator Carter.
Senator Gordley.
I mean, Senator Gordley.
It's all right.
It's all right.
No, I will just say that I will provide a courtesy vote. And in saying that, recognizing that this is preliminary, also recognizing and very mindful that there are delicate negotiations underway and that there still is opportunity, there still is hope in this process. And with that in mind, I will grant a courtesy vote.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'll join her in a courtesy, yes, for the exact same reasons. You said it better than I possibly could have. Thank you.
That's the Senate.
That's the Senate. That's a woman.
Recommendations accepted. And the next is the recommendation to accept. We need to go through the performance measures.
That's
because
right.
That's also a part of the recommendation. And I know that you have received, I thought we had received copies of theirs in the past.
Madam Chair, you have seen what I'm about to hand out before.
Yes. So would you go ahead and move them?
That Madam Chair, I move LFOs.
Senator Carter moves that we accept the performance measures as presented. Are there any objections? And you have had these, and we have discussed them.
Well, Madam Chair,
Senator.
We have seen them and we have discussed them. It's just a question of, you know, how viable are these?
Yes.
Are they? Yes?
How viable are these benchmarks and measures given the budget levels that we're looking at? So it seems to me that at some point another conversation is required that tests these benchmarks against a newer reality.
Would it be helpful if we asked the agency to give us something as to the viability of what they presented in the beginning and what is actual to date given the change both in caseload and the change in economy?
I would say yes. I would rather defer this.
We can do that.
Session.
We can do that. Okay. We will defer that and ask the agency to give us in writing the viability of the performance measures given the change in both caseloads and the economies. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you. And with that, Mr. Weeks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, members of the committee. I'm Gary Weeks, Director of the Department of Administrative Services. I'm joined here by with James Taves, who's with the department. And I don't even know the title. He can introduce himself when we get to that point. I want to just visit with you a little bit about the contract that was just recently negotiated around home health care workers and let you know what that contract involves and stuff. By way of sort of introduction, let me tell you a little bit about the population that we're trying to serve here. We have roughly 15,000 senior and disabled folks, many of them profoundly disabled, who live in their own homes and are cared for by somewhere in the neighborhood of 13,000 home care workers. Each of those clients acts as an employer and employs, selects and employs his or her own direct care worker. This is, as many of you already know, this is tough, challenging work. It's, in some cases, 24 hours, comprehensive care, feeding, bathing, toileting, all services for the client. In other cases, maybe less than that and not 24 hours, but it's difficult work, a lot of lifting and managing all the needs for the client throughout the day, the needs that the client has to be met in order to remain at home. These clients have very complex conditions and complex needs, and James is better prepared to describe some of those than I am if you'd like to go into it. But it's tough work. Many of these clients live just on the edge of poverty. So their homes are places where you spend your day that are very different than your home or my home. They're not as nice as many of us would like, and they're always not the safest place to be working, to be moving someone around who is not ambulatory at all. So the short of it is it's a pretty difficult job to have. 90% of the workers are women. They have most recently made an average of about $8.48 an hour. They have no insurance benefits. They have no workers' comp coverage. They have no days off. They do this day in and day out. And if the client can get a family member to come in and give them a reprieve, that's how they get their time off. Because, if it weren't for these workers, these home health care workers, the cost to us would be considerably more because these individuals would be in institutional care and probably mostly in a nursing home environment. Much greater cost than what we now pay for these folks. In November of 2000, there was a measure passed that you all may remember, Measure 99. Measure 99 amended Section 11 of Chapter 15, I believe it was, of the Constitution, and it amended it to create the Home Health Care Commission. The commission was charged with assuring the quality of care for all those seniors and people with disabilities that we're talking about. That measure passed in every county. It passed by a margin of 62%, so it was clear that the people were supportive of building a good, strong, stable, capable workforce to care for these people in their own homes. Home health care workers have the right to organize and to bargain, and the commission is considered, for the purposes of bargaining only, the commission is considered the employer, and that's real clear in the measure. The commission is not considered the employer for other purposes. These are not state employees. They have not been state employees in the past. But the commission is the group or the organization with which they bargain. Subsequent to the passage of the measure, the home health care workers voted to organize, and they selected SEIU Local 503, which is an OPE unit, as their represented group. They don't have the right to strike.
but they do have the right to mediation and arbitration when it comes to trying to reach a contract, to conclude a contract. Early on, the governor made the decision that he was going to support the public vote on this issue, and that he was going to in turn support the commission itself in bargaining with these employees. And that bargaining was done through my office, through DAS, which is why I'm here talking with you. The labor agreement that we reached with the home health care commissioners or home health care employees on June 17th of this year does several things. It increases the wages of these workers on July the 1st of 03, which is just passed. It increases wages by 40 cents an hour, so it brings the wage for a full-time worker to $8.96 an hour. 18 months later, on January 1 of 05, it increases the wages another 30 cents to bring the wages at the close of the biennium to $9.26. And this is if you're working full-time. The wages are less, obviously, if you're less than full-time. The contract covers these workers for workers' comp if they're at least half-time. It provides insurance benefits if they work 88 hours or more. 88 hours is a little bit more than half-time. Those insurance benefits are at the rate of $417 a month. That's the composite rate. It varies depending on whether you're full-time or part-time. To give you some sense of how that compares, that $417 a month, which doesn't begin until April 04, that's when the insurance first begins, that will match up to a state employee cost that's somewhere around $750 composite per employee. So this is not a rich benefit plan. It's not at all like what state employees receive under their contract, but it is a first-time health benefit plan for these workers.
Gary,
yes, sir, ma'am.
Thank you, Chair Winters. I guess I need some more 101 here.
Okay.
I'm still confused. The folks we're talking about are not state employees.
Correct.
Who will be paying the bill for these negotiated increases and negotiated benefits?
The state pays the bill.
Follow up. The state pays for that through contractual arrangements with private individuals. Can you help me
right
with that?
Yeah, yes, I can. Madam Chair, Representative, this is a very complex agreement. The employer is the client. Under federal law, the client has the right to hire his or her home care, direct home care giver. The state, through the commission, the health care commission, is the employer only for the purposes of bargaining a contract with the employees who are going to actually work for the client. The state pays the cost, and the general fund cost of this contract is $25 million.
So just follow up. So if I were to go into this business arena and I go out to hire my employees, I'm hiring them knowing that I have a set salary schedule and a set benefit schedule, but that's based upon a negotiated agreement that my little company would have with the state, and those costs are taken into consideration?
No, Madam Chair, Representative, you wouldn't hire them as a company. You're an individual employer. Let's say you're a person with a profound disability. You want to stay at home. You're going to hire...
I now get it.
Okay. I'm sorry. I wasn't making that clear. So they have both workers' comp coverage and health insurance coverage.
Representative Bates has a question.
Yes, okay.
Sorry, Madam Chair.
I can hold my question until you finish your testimony. It'll be probably be easier. You may even answer as we go along.
All right. Both the health care and the comp coverages begin in April of 2004. So those are both pushed off. The contract finally includes one day off during the year if you're full-time. If you're less than full-time, then you get a prorated share of one day off a year.
Excuse me, just a minute. The number of hours is how many for full-time? 88?
No, 88 hours is the number that you qualify for the health insurance benefit.
Okay.
You have to work a minimum of 88 hours, right? And we did that. Normally, half-time, Madam Chair, is 80 hours. And in order to negotiate this contract within the amount of money we had, the union agreed to push to extend the number of hours that you'd have to be eligible for health insurance above half time, the savings we pushed over into the workers' comp coverage. What really makes this agreement difficult is the whole workers' comp coverage. There's nothing like it in the country. I mean, we looked all over to try to find models. The state of California does have these workers covered under agreements, but they're a county system, and it varies by county down there. And so with workers' comp, the challenge here is there's no workplace other than the home. And so you have 13,000 people working in homes all over Oregon where you have no opportunity to go in like OSHA might and say, here's workplace safety rules or this, and we need to do this. You need to buy a lift to get this person out of bed and so on like that. So we've got great challenges in trying to figure out how to train the workers to work safely and to avoid injuries. When they are injured, then there's, you know, we have to work out who gets the 801 form, which is the form that you fill out when you're injured. How does it get to the insurance company? In this case, SAFE will be the insurance carrier. We've already negotiated that. The worker gets the, let's say they do get the 801 form filled out and they get it to the right place, then they're on leave. They're on work leave and they're on a benefit at that point. The client has to have another employee right away. So we assign another employee. In the worst case scenario, the client decides, I like this new person a lot better than I like the old one, and since under federal law they get to hire their own person, they can decide to keep the new person. And the person that was injured, who is now ready to come back to work, doesn't have any place to go, and we have to get them back to work because we're paying time loss all the time on this. So they go right, you know, we're working on a system where they go back to the top of the registry and we place them immediately so we get away from the time loss. But it's a very complicated system to try to manage, and I think our colleagues from the union will tell you we worked hard to try to work this out. We spent a lot of time with SAFE. We're designing some real unique training programs that can be offered to these workers so that we avoid the accidents and so on. And they're probably not going to be catastrophic accidents here. They're going to be strains and sprains and those kinds of things. I mean, it's unlikely that there'll be loss of life or anything of that nature. But strains and sprains, which put people off work and cause lost time wages, are expensive. I mean, we learned that from Fairview. All the years that we offered Fairview. So we're trying to get ahead of this. And because the workers' comp and the health insurance doesn't actually start until April of 2004, we've got several months for us to work in partnership with the union and with our insurers, both the health insurer and the workers' comp insurer, to try to put in place things that will mitigate these costs. The only way that we could get health insurance for these folks, though, was to have workers' comp. A health insurance carrier isn't going to come in and pick up a population like this without some workers' comp, because they know they're going to be paying for a lot of workers' comp claims on the side and stuff. So we had to negotiate both. And on the health insurance side, you have the same issues about who handles the processing of the health insurance claim, because there, again, no employer. And the agreements that we've worked out with the union is that the union is actually going to be the third party health insurance provider. They will manage the claims and so on like that. We will hire another firm, a private firm, to manage the claims on the workers' comp side. So we've had to work that all that through at the same time. So it's
Gary, is the union being the third party for the health insurance, are they being remunerated for being the third party? Are they generating their revenue from the from dues?
Madam Chair, the union is receiving a contract just like if we hired any other third-party vendor, because if they didn't do it, we'd had to hire another third-party vendor. So, and we struck what I think is a very fair arrangement with the union to manage those health care claims.
I have two questions then. My question then is, how much is that contract? And secondly, you know, I'm assuming that now that the home care employees are unionized, and even though we're giving them raises, how much of the raises then going into dues?
Madam Chair, it would depend on how much.
Keep, in other words.
Madam Chair, it would depend on how much the employee works, and I think there are union representatives here. I can't tell you what the fair share structure is. Frankly, I've never looked at it, but it would vary depending on with how much they work, and they do pay fair share, just like all other union members do. The cost that we negotiated on the insurance administration claims and the workers' comp for the insurance claim cost for the biennium are $358,560. For the comp side, it's $251,196. And those were based on, in part, on information we got from other third-party vendors who bid on this, and that's how we came up with what we thought was a reasonable cost to do this.
Senator Gordley.
At this wage rate, even with the increase in wages that you talked about, I would guess that many of these are employees who are eligible for food stamps.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, some may be, depending on the size of their family and so on, because at the end of this contract, the wage for person working full-time will be about $9.26 an hour is what the wage will be. So if you had a fairly large family, yeah, I think you could probably still qualify for food stamps.
Have we done that analysis?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, about how many of them would qualify? No, Senator Gordley, we have not done an analysis like that.
Yeah, we need to do that.
I'm sure that in working with the union, we could do that, Senator.
We need to do that, and I would also like to have some clearer picture of this population of women.
Yes.
That we're talking about, what the age breakdown is, and where these women are, geographically speaking, doing this work, hard work.
Very hard work, Senator. And I think we can probably break it down by age group. I know we can geographically because we know where the clients are.
Mm-hmm.
So we know that the workers will be in that area also.
Mm-hmm. And while you're getting the information, I would like to know how much that they are able to net, how much of it's coming off the top. So I'm sure that SEIU has done some calculations on what their dues or their fee revenue is generating, and I think you can take from that and begin to calculate whether or not the person is getting much less.
There was something else, Madam Chair.
Senator,
thank you.
Gordley.
I thought I heard you say something about one day off. Could you reframe that? What were you wanting us to understand?
We were negotiating, Madam Chair and Senator Gordley, around time off because they've never had paid time off. And so we've as a part of the contract, provided for a day off, and the employee can take it if they're full time. They can take a full day off.
Is that once a year, once a month,
yeah.
Once a?
It's a day.
A day a year.
Yeah. I'm sorry. I thought they were trying to correct me. It's one day a year. This is not a generous time off benefit, and they have to work it into their work schedule. So, Senator Gordley, we will get that information for you. And, Madam Chair, we'll work with the union to get the cost of the fair share, depending on the level of work that employees do, and compare that with their wages.
Representative Bates and then Representative Smith.
A couple of quick questions, Gary. And if you can't answer these right now, I understand. Give us the answers later. I reiterate what we've been hearing. These people, because I know many of them, work extremely hard, long hours, difficult job. They are not getting anywhere near what she had compensated for. The questions I have revolve around the workforce and the client base. First one is, once this is in place, are you going to try to track the turnover amongst these people? What we've seen before is a pretty high turnover because the pay was low, the job was tough. And a lot of people would work for 2 or 3 months and then move on to other jobs. It'd be interesting to see if that turnover slows some, because the longer somebody works for a particular client, obviously the better they serve that client and the better the relationship is between them, generally speaking. So that'd be something interesting if you have any way of easily tracking that. Don't want to add a lot of administrative cost here.
No, Madam Chair, Representative Bates, we can and have tracked that. I mean,
James may have better information than I have, but the data that I last saw, the turnover rate was about 73-74% in this population. And that's partly why we believe that if there's some benefits here, you know, you've got some health care benefits, some compensation benefits and stuff, we're going to be able to retain this workforce a little bit longer. And the way that the contract is set up, you actually have to work for 2 months before you get benefits. So you just can't come in and out. You, in order to qualify for health care benefits, you have to work 2 months, at least 88 hours, and then you qualify for benefits. But we can track that, and we'll track that.
Second question?
Follow-up.
The client base you're looking at has been hit by six special sessions. We've had to change. We've had to cut appropriations. Have you seen a decrease in the number of clients you're serving, or an increase, or has it made no difference?
Let me turn to James, if I may, Representative.
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, we cut through all the level cuts, all close to 5,000 clients out of service, 4,000-something, but it's in the proximity of 5,000 clients. And many of those, in fact, the majority of those, I believe, were in in-home services.
Follow-up, Madam Chair.
Follow-up.
Since you've had that decrease in the client base, where have those people gone? Have we seen an increase in people going to residential care, into assisted living, into extended care facilities? Do you have any idea what happened to those people?
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, the answer is no, because they were eliminated from eligibility from our service system in its entirety. So if they lost in-home care services, they did not then become eligible for ALFs or nursing facilities or other things. We have still a substantial group that's in the hearing process, in contested case hearings, contesting the loss of eligibility itself. We have a lot of individuals that are still in the facilities, even though the state has stopped payment. If the contested case hearing is done with, they're sitting in an ALF or a nursing facility, even though the state has stopped paying, and families are scrambling to find other alternatives. I mean, there's just many thousands of stories about what's happened to clients as a result of the cuts. But they're not showing up. Some of them are coming back with more severe disabilities. I mean, people that lost medically needy, and because of the loss of drugs, have gotten sicker. And so they can come back as eligible under the lower levels, or the higher levels, I should say, because of the loss of services, and we anticipated that even in the original cuts, that there would be a percentage return as people lost services, they would get sicker or their needs would escalate, and they would then become eligible with a higher impairment level.
Madam Chair, I think this is an important issue for us, and I'd really like to get some good data. I'd like to know, does this care keep people out of extended care facilities? Does it not? Or does it? And what is the effect on those people when you cut these services off, as we've forced you to do? I'd like to get as clear a picture of that as we could, because it might guide us in what we're looking at as far as further cuts are concerned, or add-backs either way. If you can supply meaningful data for that, I think it'd be helpful. I mean, it's really important to know, does this kind of care really keep people out of long-term care facilities and more expensive placements? Are there a gray area where it doesn't? I really don't know, and I'd like information that would help us make that decision if we could.
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, we can provide that. And I can tell you, if you baseline this before the cuts, out of the 30-plus thousand people that we have served in long-term care in Oregon, way over half were served in-home. And Oregon is just off the chart compared to most other states, where the bulk of people are in long-term care in facilities or foster care or nursing facilities. So the record sort of speaks for itself. Now how the cuts have affected all that have created new challenges for us, but we can supply that data.
I think it would be nice if we have that data, not only in looking at the this particular aspect, but also we've been trying to validate the issue of our continuum of care with OPI and all of those systems, because we have said the policy discussion has been that if you have a person in OPI, you're saving money and keeping them from going into the next level of care and you know, on up the ladder. Mm-hmm. And so it would be very helpful, and I agree with Representative Bates, if we have some trend line, some data to validate, you know, all of this discussion that we're having. If you cut here, what does that do there? And so that would be very helpful. I'll get back to you, Representative Smith, and then Senator Marsat.
Thank you, Chair Winters. I never want to second-guess you fellows on this issue, but I do share the same concerns as Senator Gordley on the one day. And without knowing all the details, to me it would seem like some of these folks we ought to be giving parades to. And one day a year seems awfully stingy. With that said, I still have a missing link on an earlier question I had. These folks, for IRS tax purposes, do they get a 1099? Do the people they're employed by fill out a Schedule C? How does I've got a missing link here.
You know, Madam Chair, Representative Smith, they will. We have to change our payroll system actually at DHS to do this because they will get a tax form.
A 1099? Because are they now a contractor of the state?
Representative, I'm not sure if it's a 1099, but we have historically paid these folks through a warrant process and stuff. Now we're actually going to issue a check, and that check will have all the tax information on it and so on. But I'm not sure if it's a 1099. I'm sorry, I can check and find that out.
It's a W-2.
It's a standard W-2, but...
Without taking time of the committee, I'd be very interested in knowing how you get around the independent contractor status laws of the state without having them as state employees, et cetera. And if someone could address that in the future, I'd appreciate
it. Because I think we talked about that. If we didn't, I intended to. The whole independent contractor issue, you know, when you go from a warrant, that's one thing. When you go from a W-2 and assume all the other responsibilities, it's another. And I, too, would like to have further discussion and information on that because from what you're describing, there is an employee and employer relationship.
Exactly.
Now, maybe it's the commission that separates it, but I think I would like to have an opinion on whether it is. We are in a position of violating the Independent Contracts Act.
We're on a fine
line.
Madam Chair and Representative Smith, we spent a lot of time with the AG on questions around this contract and looked at this issue itself. I mean, the federal law makes the client the employer because they can hire and fire and dismiss
could,
and
could
so on.
Could you get us some opinions in writing? That would help me a lot.
Madam Chair and Representative Smith will put together what we have.
Just very quickly, because if that person then becomes the provider, then they, by our IRS tax code, are going to be obligated to fulfill a Schedule C, and I'd be interested if the 13,000 or whatever the number is are going to be all filling out Schedule Cs for IRS tax code purposes.
We'll look into that, Representative.
Another Representative Smith and Marsat, and then I have another question that I'd like to ask pertaining to the health benefits. Representative T. Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think there's no doubt this committee thinks these people are worthy, but I don't think that's really the issue. We haven't really talked about what I consider the issue here, and that is when these $25 million of raises were given, what made these people more of a priority in our state budget than any other worthy program out there?
Mm-hmm. Well, Madam Chair, Senator or Representative Smith, I think what made them a priority for the governor was his concern that these are supporting 15,000 clients whose expenses would be dramatically greater for the state if we were not able to provide a stable, quality workforce that we knew was going to be there and in place. And failing to do that would have cost us considerably more than $25 million to maintain these people. That was the belief behind this. And
follow up.
You know, you could say that about virtually any other state service we offer. And through the governor's own words, he says, look, folks, you know, we need to freeze salaries. We have frontline state employees out there working, I think, just as hard as our in-home providers do, but yet those salaries and wage benefits were probably frozen, maybe not the benefits, but their wages had been frozen, and yet we're able to go outside, or you're able to go outside the legislative process, outside our bargaining unit, outside the leadership negotiations, and give $25 million in raises, and the legislature has absolutely no say in it.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Smith, the legislature actually does have a say in it, because these kind of increases for these workers have to run back through the MULT crack, which is in statute. They have to review those changes. Then that has to go to either the emergency board, the legislature, one or the other, for eventual approval. So, in fact, they do have to run back through, and the Attorney General was real clear on that because I asked him for his advice on how that would work.
Follow up. But still there's the issue of other state employees having wage freezes, why this group doesn't. And you can even argue whether they're state employees or not, since we have this private contractor status in question. We don't even know. But if you were to consider them as part of the private sector, the wages in the private sector's hourly wages are not going up. In fact, we're holding in line on those also. Now, I'm not saying that these people don't deserve it. I think probably everybody in this room, including the legislature, deserves a raise, but the money just isn't there. And yet we're going out here and freewheeling it and, you know, doing it because we think these people are more worthy than anybody else out there, and I have just a little bit of objection to that.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I understand your concern about that, but this is a population of folks who we have had great difficulty trying to keep on the job. I mean, mid-70% turnover with these folks. They get basically near minimum wage. You know, many of them, were it not for this, were qualifying for food stamps. Many of them were on our health plan, the Oregon Health Plan. So this is a population that, unlike today's state employees, whose wages are, you know, I won't say, you know, they're more than adequate, but they're, you know, they are what they are, and they have a solid health care benefit. They are covered by workers' comp. They get a day a week off or a day a month off for vacation. They get 2 days personal leave. They are in a very different economic situation than these 13,000 employees that we are trying to keep stable so we don't get these clients into nursing homes. So we believe that they were not like the other workforce, and that was the position the governor took.
I do, and I'll get to Senator Morris because I know they're waiting. But you mentioned it, so I would like to follow up. How many of these individuals do you estimate are currently, probably are in our Oregon Health Plan that we're paying for on that side that with this now would no longer be in the Oregon Health Plan?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure, but we can run the records on this. What we had was, during the negotiations, were clear anecdotal stories of people even at the table negotiating who had qualified for the health plan.
If you could provide that information to me, I would appreciate it.
Madam Chair, we will.
Senator Morissette.
Thank you. This is kind of a follow-up to Representative Smith's question. I think it would be very helpful to see something in writing, like a spreadsheet that compares the monthly cost of an in-home worker to the monthly cost of nursing home or some other type of care. The 88 hours, now, from what I gather, 80 hours is half-time?
Correct.
And that's 80 hours a week?
It's 80 hours a month, Senator.
80 hours a month. Right. Are they, how, okay, these are
they
not
probably work 80 hours.
Stay in the home.
Senator Morris,
what is 80 hours a month, 40 hours, so these are 40 hour a week employees, and so how many I guess what I'm getting at, how many people are employed by a single client? If they're only working 40 hours a week and they need 24 hour care, does that mean they have three people working for them?
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, those that have 24-hour care may even have live-in care, you know, so there's not transition. Or they may have more than one. They may have two people that are rotating in. Not all of these clients require 24-hour care. I'm not, James, do you know roughly the percentage that are 24-hour?
No, I think that require 24 hours.
So roughly 10% would require 24-hour care, okay. Madam Chair, Senator Morissette. And so there could be live-in care that's there all the time, or there could be more than one caregiver that comes in and out. And if I can just jump back to the 1 day a week, which sounds, I agree, or 1 day of vacation a year, miserly. When we were negotiating this contract, for every day that someone is off, we have to backfill for that person. And it simply, you know, it was a cost issue for us. You know, how much could we afford to backfill for 13,000 people who were taking 13,000 days off times how many days off you want to give them?
Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Gary, would it be possible to give us the spreadsheet and the assumptions that are behind the $25 million budget allocation for this biennium? The reason I ask that is that we did considerable work on this in my office, and the numbers that we have come up with are far different, and so we must have been using some different assumptions.
Sure.
And then also, that would be current, and then where you think this is going, because I think this has the potential of ballooning significantly, and you know the other shoe will drop in the future.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Morris, I don't want to mislead you at all. The roll-up costs on this are significantly more because we've pushed back the start of the workers' compensation. We pushed back the start of the health insurance. We pushed back the start of the second year raise to just the last 6 months. So the roll-up cost on this could be, you're probably going to be in the neighborhood of about $50 million in the next biennium to roll all those costs up. Now, remember, this is a negotiated agreement. And so at the end of this biennium, we sit down and we renegotiate again. The current contract actually has a opener that we agreed with, that the union agreed with us, and the opener is to the effect that if the workers' comp costs trend is higher than what we expect, we can open the contract shortly down the road. Because there's so many unknowns with this population, we don't know how much they're going to use the comp. So we have a reopener to protect ourselves that way. But we will renegotiate every biennium.
Thank you. That would be very helpful because I believe our estimates are much greater than any of the numbers that you shared today. And I do have some concerns about that.
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, that's because what we're talking about today is the general fund cost. We're not talking about the total cost. The general fund cost is $25 million. When you bring the Medicaid match in that these folks get and so on, the total cost is higher than $25 million. So that may be why your numbers are off. But we will put together the data that we used to price all this out for you. And Madam Chair, for the committee, I should say.
Well, would you allow me just 1 minute to vent just a little bit? And it has to do, this is, by the way, these people deserve, without question, I mean, the work that they do, I've seen it, and we appreciate what they do, so it's not without merit. But the issue here is what the public has done to the legislature through the initiative process that lands in our lab expenses that were not anticipated in anybody's plan, particularly at a time when we don't have funds to do it. So I pointed out just as a fact that oftentimes this body is criticized because it's spending out of control by the people out here in our districts, but yet at the same time, through Measure 5, 11, you know, all 88, 99, this being 99, right, land in our lab obligations without any identified source of funding. So I'm done.
No, you're absolutely correct. I was speaking with someone in my community, and this happened to become a subject, and they said, oh, I didn't know that the state was going to have to pay for this. You know, I voted for it. And you're right. We do get through the initiative process, which we all embrace the process, but there are things that occur as a result that this body has to deal with financially that has been driven by our citizens in our community. And you are correct. This has been on the radar screen now for, it was there last session. That there was funds that got the commission started, and so now this session, the commission and the work with the Department of Administrative Services has done their negotiations. But it is something that I think we as policymakers don't often get to do everything we think that we're going to do, because we have the citizens of our state who either say, you haven't done it, or we're going to find another vehicle with which to solve it. I would agree with, and Senator Carter's going to get me because she's got to go at 3 o'clock. So I'm going to yield.
We've been trying to ask the question since 2:30.
Yeah. Senator Carter, I'm going to let her. And no one has fed Rosie, so you get one question.
Thank you very, very much. Mr. Weeks, put your hat back on as head of the Department of Human Services and go back to 1985. Let all of my dear colleagues up here know how much it costs the state before all these people got to work,
yes,
taking care of all of those people that were in DHS. Can you remember?
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, a lot. That's all I can remember. I don't know the I don't know the numbers, but it was an extraordinary amount of money.
Colleagues, the only thing I'm saying is the cost that we're paying for these people to care for our citizens in their homes is minute compared to what it was when they were in the institution. That's all I want to say.
But could we get something on that, though? Some
We've asked for some trend line information, and you might want to include in that what if we were continuing in before deinstitutionalization occurred in this state, what did it look like, and if you did the population numbers, what that would mean and its impact. I think we can do that. That's the same when we're talking about the deinstitutionalization of Fairview. All of these issues play into what we're talking about today. I don't think we can talk about any piece of human services without looking at the public policy that has been made over time. And this didn't just happen overnight. I want everybody to know that it did not happen overnight. That it's played over time, that we have moved from not only in Oregon but across the country from institutionalizing individuals in care to putting individuals into communities to where they can have a optimum way of life. And that occurred with all populations. It's not just been one population. And so it is a difference in cost when you're talking about institutional care versus community care. And I think you can give us some trend line information that what happened when we made our changes. And I see my staff here looking for me, too, as well.
Madam Chair, we have very good numbers on Fairview. I mean, I closed Fairview, and James did all the heavy lifting, and we have very, very good numbers on what it was costing us per resident of Fairview compared to when those residents moved into the community and the cost from living in the community. But beyond the cost was the difference in lifestyle for those people living in the community.
Further questions? Come in, Senator Gordley.
Yeah, this is a constructive criticism of our process here today. What we've heard from Mr. Weeks is an oral presentation about a process that's been underway for a while involving the Home Health Care Commission. But I'm not aware of any written documents that lay out how this process has moved forward and what those various details are. I say that given also recognizing I have a stack of paper on my desk, too, that I haven't been able to get to all of it. It's just that this is a huge issue, and we're talking about it in some ways out of context. It wasn't even on our agenda, not posted for informational discussion, which is what we've been having. And I just think we need to be mindful about that, the process part of this that is also about informing the public about what we're going to be talking about, and then the process part that says bring some documents with you that describe and define the process that's been underway, which enables us to better understand what you're talking about, what we're all talking about. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Weeks was asked, Senator Gordon, last minute to come, so
I can appreciate that, mm-hmm. but I still have the same constructive criticism.
I understand.
It's well taken.
Very well taken.
We'll do that.
Dr. Bates.
The only thing different I'd ask is you've been asked to give us some financial data on the situation. You know, I like to see some financial data along with it, what this has done for the home care workers themselves. How many of them are off welfare payments? How many are off of food stamps? How many are off OHP? Cost to the state, they're going to go away as they become more self-sufficient because they're going to start receiving a living wage, mm-hmm. or at least be approaching a living wage. And that should be part of the documentation, too. Another thing they're going to do for us is this is Oregon's a donor state. For the money we send to Washington, D.C., we get about 85 cents back. When you bring that federal match money back to the state, it brings revenue back to the state that we wouldn't have otherwise. The other thing these people do, they're going to start paying taxes for us.
Mm-hmm.
Our revenue's been down a little bit lately. I probably haven't noticed, but it's been down a smidgen. And when more people go back to work, our revenues go back up.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very complex picture. I like to see all that brought forward when we look at these situations.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, colleagues, very much. Let's go to the committee. John.